Chapter 3. It was a fantastic place for a city. High up, away from the rads and the filth, one of the few places that had never been despoiled, still hard and clear and unsullied. Candlewire didn't approve of everything that had been done over the last 50 years of debate and disagreement, but building the seat of unity here was evidently the correct decision. All still living on Terra looked up to this place. No warlord had ever conquered it. The masses would lift their heads from their seamy plains and swamps, turn away from the degraded hive sumps and sprawl cities, and see something untrammelled rise into impossible heights, clean and unmatchable, a signal to the future. One day, of course. For now, it was a building site, the largest ever marshalled by human hands, toiling against the punishing elements to raise an icon of defiance. It was cold, the mud was frozen, the lumens would blink out at a moment's notice, the piped water was gritty and seldom got hot, even when the generator banks were working. That last one was an irritant. After the long atmospheric stage to Himalaya, it would have been good to relax in a pulse shower, washing the dust from her body. But instead, it had been a matter of grimly bearing the ice-cold spears of water before they gutted out in a splurt of muck. The torrent of expletives from her chambers had been enough to send orderlies scurrying, but there was little they could do when the whole complex was still half-finished. She emerged in a foul state, her hair disarranged and sodden, all fatigue dispelled by fury. She stomped into the antechamber where her aide-de-camp, Armina, was wrestling with a pile of comm-tubes freshly dispatched by a messenger drone. "I'm running late," Candlewire announced. Armina looked up at her, brushing away a strand of hair. Candlewire was as black as jet. Armina was as white as chalk. Candlewire's hair was wiry and unruly, Armina's was straw-pale and flat. The two of them were like the termini of a spectrum illustration, the full range of humanity, its vigorous extremes still popping up after tangled millennia of mingled breeding. "He will expect you to be on time," Armina said, sniffing in disapproval. Candlewire went over to a sideboard and reached for a jewellery casket. "You have no appreciation for status, Armina," she said. "What signal would it send if I turned up in the slot he'd offered me?" She picked out a silver necklace studded with tiny pearls, lifting it up to the light. "I'm a bloody high lord. I turn up when I want to." Armina shook her head. "You could wear it a little more lightly." Candlewire turned, holding the necklace up to her throat. "Really? I like it." "Your office." Armina went back to sorting the comm tubes, extracting the ciphered innards and placing them in the correct order into the speaker coils. "This bravado fools only fools. He'd only have to flick his fingers," Armina snapped her own, "and that would be your neck gone." "He'd not dare," said Candlewire, unclasping the chain and donning it. "There's more than one kind of strength, something I keep telling you." "Over and over," Armina mumbled. "The law binds them," Candlewire went on. "That's what makes this emperor worth serving." The clasp clicked closed, and she let her hands fall again. "At least, that is what we must believe." "Will you at least make the attempt not to insult him?" Candlewire tilted a mirror and adjusted her scarf and wrapped dress. "He is a custodian. They are, so I have always been led to believe, impervious to insults. We are like gnats to them, less than gnats. Our bites don't penetrate their skin." Armina put the last tube into the last coil. "There is much to do here," she said chidingly. "You have been away for a long time already, working on whatever it is. You have responsibilities, High Lord." Candlewire came up to her, took both her hands in her own. "I know. That is why I do this. Keep putting things in order for me." Armina smiled. "So you can disarrange them again?" That's my job. Armina pulled her hands away and returned to the coils. Her fingers danced over the controls, and sigils began to pulse into the decoders. At least then be careful, she said. Ensure you retain contact with Ofa, said Kandawire, walking towards the great doors. If you wish to worry about anyone, worry about him. I, on the other hand, as always, will be fine. That was not strictly accurate. For most of her life, Uwama Kandawire had been very far from fine. It had been a vanishingly rare thing on Terra for anyone at all to be fine. In close and living memory, the entire planet had been a gangster-riddled rock, squabbled over only by the amoral and the debauched. Every part of it had been backward and dangerous, and staying alive had been a matter of luck, or maybe deviousness, or maybe, just now and then, judgment. She had been born into a relatively wealthy family within what had then been the Banda Confederacy, in the extreme southeastern corner of Afrik. Modest wealth allowed them certain privileges, security guards around the edge of their compound, a degree of regularity in food supply, access to what few trappings of civilization still clung on along the baked dry coastal belt. She still remembered, as a young girl, sitting on the deserted beach in the evening, the sand dirty, the desiccated old ocean bowl just a few meters from her gritty bare feet. Flickers of distant lightning had been dancing along an infinite horizon. Those living nearby had called the ocean, while it had existed, Zodasa, endless, as if it had never found another shore. Kandawire knew better. There were a few vid books in her mother's library, and one of those contained an atlas. The lithcast unit had broken a long time ago, but you could still shine a torch through the aperture and project the blurred trace of the coastlines onto a whitewashed wall. Once she'd learned that trick, she'd spent hours marking them out, trying to read the tiny labels, and wondering what kinds of people lived in those places that she would never be able to visit. She imagined them all naturally as being much like her. Maybe many of them were wise and cultivated, living in cities lined with orange groves and water fountains. Or maybe most were like the Zoipa, the savages of the north with their red-painted trucks and flame-bringers, who lived in hovels, ate human flesh for sustenance, and raided for what little else they wanted. She remembered sitting by the thin bars of the electro-heater in the evenings, her dress itchy from the dust, as her father traced his own bony finger along the burned stick marks she had made on the wall. "You could once travel from here to here," he had said, jabbing at islands and inlets running up the eastern seaboard. "There were cities this far up once. Huge, huge places built on concrete platforms out into the sea. They sucked the water up, like you suck goat's milk through a straw, and scrubbed the salt from it. That was the only way they could keep the people from dying of thirst." "What do they do now?" she had asked, wide-eyed, chewing on her fingernails. "I do not know," her father had said. "Nothing works much anymore. Perhaps the Zoipa raided there, like they did everywhere else. I expect those cities are empty now." That had made her angry. All such stories had made her angry. "Why does nothing work anymore?" she had demanded. She still remembered her father's stubbly chin, his face that was skinny from not getting enough to eat, and those sad, intelligent eyes. "Because the warrior is in charge, Kondedwa. Whenever the warrior is in charge, things stop working. For things to work, the warrior is the servant of the worker. You see it? The worker makes things work.
The warrior makes
wars." But the warriors were the only ones who made anything back then. They were the only ones with the weapons, with the coin, with the energy. Nothing could stand in their way for long. When the mood came upon them, as it did often, They would ravage down the long, dry coast, burning and breaking. The sand would darken with blood for a few days, and the red earth would grow sticky with engine oil, and no one would sit under the shadow of the splintered palms and gaze out over the empty sea. Now, when Kandawaya thought back, she wondered that she had survived at all. Her mother had not, dying of the cancer that was now easily treatable in major imperial cities, a result, Kandawaya found out later, of the radiation-laced munitions still lurking in the grit of her homeland. Her father did not either. The raids eventually reached far enough south to swallow up the family compound, just as they had done to so many others, snuffing out the few bright points of sanctuary along that desolate littoral. It had been Ofar who had rescued her. Ofar, with his spindly limbs and bulging eyes. Ofar looked like a child's rag toy, which was why no one took him seriously. He had pulled her from her cot and tried to huddle her out to the last of the land transports before the Zoipa broke through the perimeter. Precocious as ever, she had not let him drag her to safety, but had stamped her feet and refused to go, until he had rescued the vidbook projector, too. She had not gone back for her father. She had not gone back for any of the staff who had nursed and entertained her. Back then, with a spoiled child's sense of self-importance, she had wanted the one thing that made her happy, that allowed her to dream of other worlds and other places. Kandawaya still winced at the memory. It had haunted her ever since, spiking at her conscience. She could have done nothing much to help, in all honesty, but still it rankled that she had never tried. All she had left now were those memories, those injunctions. The worker makes things work. Now, in the high airs above the palace's central zone within her luxurious air car, Kandawaya looked over at the pilot of the flyer with her starched collar and trim epaulets. She glanced at the guards on either side of her, a man and a woman, both in the heavy chainmail armour that gave her that elusive sense of physical security. They performed their duties with a quiet attention to detail that reflected well, not only on them, but on the system that had created them. Kandawaya could raise her pudgy, ring-encrusted finger, and they would follow any order she gave them. The warrior is the servant of the worker. So fragile, that arrangement, so easy to pull apart. "Bring us down on the minor platform, please," Kandawaya said. The pilot nodded, and the air cap dipped into a controlled descent. Ahead of them, the skeleton of third prescribed area, known by anyone with any decent information as the Tower of Hegemon, filled the forward viewscreens. It looked like some heavy outer shielding was being lifted into position, obscuring a thick core of rockcrete piles. The topmost pinnacle was like a finger flayed of its flesh, a needle of bone against the white sky. They docked at the lesser of the two air platforms to be greeted by a welcome party of tower serfs. As ever, they were polite, soft-spoken, with eyes that seemed to see right through you. The passage to the Captain General's private chambers was efficient and quick, laced with expert small talk. The one who accompanied her, a slim woman with amber-brown skin called Calyx, had the polished air of an aristocrat, or perhaps an academic, or maybe an archaeologist. She asked courteous questions, gave semi-contentful answers, and smiled coolly the whole time. It was so hard not to hate those people. Soon they were all gone, along with Kandawaya's bodyguards, leaving her alone in a marble-floored chamber of white stone walls. Late afternoon sun filtered in through narrow windows designed to look like enlarged arrow slits. The architecture was monolithic, like some fortress or castle from the forgotten past. There were no pictures, no ornaments, no fountains or decorative plants. The entire space was cold, pale, flat, and unreflective. Set in the heart of the floor, before the largest set of windows, were two seats facing one another. The one on the left was of human dimensions and stood empty. The one on the right was twice the size and was occupied.
"Sit, please,"
its owner said, gesturing to the empty space. Before she knew what she was doing, Kandawaya found herself complying. Then she looked up and faced, for the first time ever at such close range, the object of her inquiries. Valdor, the Emperor's spear. It was impossible, even for her, not to feel a spike of fear. It was impossible not to sense the cold sweat rising, the fight-or-flight mechanism kick in, the desire to look away, to reach for something to defend herself with. With effort, she met his gaze.
"A good journey?" he asked.
It would have been nice to have replied with something clever or defiant, something fitting her high station. In the event, she found her mouth had gone strangely dry.
"Yes,"
was all she could get out. At least, though, it was begun now. She had been told it would never happen, that he would never agree, and that it would be a waste of her time, since nothing could be discovered from this source that he did not wish to be discovered. They had all been wrong about the first of those. Hopefully, they would be wrong about the rest, too. She took a breath.
"Constantine Valdor, Captain General of the Legio Custodes," she said, trying to keep her voice level. "By the authority vested in me by the High Council of Terra, I hereby place you under a state of formal inquiry. By statute of the Lex Pacifica, you're required to answer all and any of my questions. An Audex transcript will be made available in due course. Do you have any queries before we begin?"
He was so like the rest of them, so calm, so icily assured. She wondered then if anything ever had given him a reason to break a sweat or to lose that magisterial air of total command. This was a farce. He could end it at any time, and there was nothing she could do. She wondered, her heart thudding, if Armina was right, and this whole charade was little more than a signature over her death warrant. But she had to keep going now. It had been started and must now be finished.
"None at all, High Lord,"
Valdor said, placing his hands lightly on his lap.
"I suggest we commence. So, what do you wish to know?"